Interested in the forces shaping our world? The Council on Foreign Relations has you covered. For those who like to look ahead, dive into The World Next Week, hosted by Bob McMahon and Carla Ann Robbins.
We were not forecasting anything about Russian domestic upheaval, and yet that has been the story of the week.
These were scorpions going after each other in a bottle.
And for those who want to go beyond the headlines, join Jim Lindsay as he opens up the president's inbox.
What should U.S. policy do?
The approach towards China, it's enough to make me question bipartisanship.
And finally, join me, Gabrielle Sierra, on Why It Matters, as my guests and I bring some of the world's most compelling stories home to you.
Do you feel good about where we're heading with AI?
Maybe we need to invent a new word here, which kind of is a combination of frightened and excited.
I'm
excited.
So what are you waiting for?
For the world next week, the president's inbox.
And Why It Matters. We'll see you soon.
The border wall with Mexico, once fiercely opposed by Democrats, now the Biden White House is scrapping rules to build even more wall. We hear from an expert on how well barriers work in immigration policy.
Trying to stop that type of migration with a wall is like trying to retain water with your hands.
Also on the show, if it's for Elon Musk, Malaysia's prime minister is happy to bend affirmative action policy.
I'm in business, and whatever is necessary will be done.
He hopes Musk will choose Malaysia for Tesla's regional plant. I'm Marco Werman, and we remember acclaimed Syrian writer Khaled Khalifa, a man whose big heart kept him in the country right through the civil war.
He was like the Santa Claus with his like white beard, walking with a big smile and beautiful eyes shining all the time, sending love wherever he goes.
Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us on this Thursday. We begin today at the U.S. southern border with Mexico, where the Biden administration this week made a shift in its policy. It plans to build additional sections of the border wall in Texas. Using an executive order, President Biden waived 26 laws in order to make this happen. The reason given is the rising number of migrants crossing into the U.S. without authorization. This decision comes as U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is in Mexico to discuss border and immigration issues with their officials. New York City Mayor Eric Adams is also in Mexico today.
When you see children making the long trek through a jungle, and then having to live in conditions of congregate shelters, it just makes it extremely challenging.
New York is facing a crisis of its own as thousands of migrants are bused from southern states to northern ones. For more, we're turning to Elizabeth Vallée. She joins us from Montreal, where she is the director of the Center for Geopolitical Studies at the University of Quebec. Elizabeth, how surprised are you by this shift the Biden White House has taken? I mean, he's following Trump's example and is building more of the southern border wall.
Well, it is. On the first day of his presidency, he clearly stated that there would never be another piece of wall erected along the southern border. The truth is, it has not been the case. Actually, we've seen pieces of borders being of border walls being erected here and there. So this is not new. What's new here is really the 26 waivers, the choice the presidency has made to waive some very important laws concerning the Clean Air Act, water, environment, and this will have a tremendous impact on a border region which is very rich, environmentally speaking.
Right, and that suggests Biden is intent on getting these sections of the wall up. So what has forced his hand to follow the policy of his predecessor?
That's a good question. He just actually answered this just a while ago, that he was forced by the law, that the money was already appropriated, was allocated, and had to be spent. And as he was being asked if he thought the policy of border walling worked, he clearly answered no. Period. So he says that his hands are legally tied, but that doesn't explain the 26 waivers once again.
Well, we heard Mayor Eric Adams earlier in Mexico also hoping for some relief. So as states in the Northeast U.S. are now feeling the pinch of the migration crisis, do you think maybe that forced Biden's hands here? Or maybe there's something else at play on the political front that could be pushing this?
That's what the U.S. are also looking at. They know those people that are coming up, a lot of them from Venezuela. and are coming up towards the US, towards Canada, we know they're coming to our borders. So definitely there will be more migrants coming to the border, more people looking for asylum. And that's maybe where the border wall is a bit accessory in a way. Most people will turn themselves in once they cross the border. Most people, or a lot, at least a tenth of those people, will be crossing through regular ports of entry. Even the wording of illegal immigration doesn't say what it is clearly. It's really people asking for a better life, and a better life sometimes is just barely being able to survive. So I think the president, as we are all watching the news and what's going on in the world, we are seeing more and more people coming towards the north, towards our borders, but a border wall will not do anything. So that's why it's mainly about marketing and spectacle. We are showing that we're doing something.
Right. Well, of course, next year is an election year, so politicians are naturally looking for spectacle. But I have to ask, I mean, will building more wall actually work for the short-term objectives that Biden has stated about limiting migration?
Well, for the very short term, on the very spot where it's being built, it may have an impact. But if we were to look at what CBP has once stated, it's not on their website anymore, at what the GAO has stated recently, on what even the Finnish border guard, if we are looking elsewhere as they are building a fence along the Russian border, have stated, a border wall is not a deterrent. A border wall is merely a speed bump. So it will not prevent people from coming in. It may slow them down for a while, and then they will do as they've been doing elsewhere, trying to stop that type of migration with a wall is like trying to retain water with your hands. At one point, it will not work, obviously.
Wow. Well, you've researched walls, Elizabeth, not just on the U.S. southern border, but all over the world. You mentioned Finland and their border with Russia. Where else have you seen walls and border fences becoming policy around migration? And do they ever work? Have you ever seen them work in the long term?
So in the long term, they do not work. They create more problems, actually. They disrupt borderlands and ecosystems, and they do generate problems that will have to be addressed on public funds, which is the irony, right? Because we're using public funding most of the time to build border walls, then create more problems and have to invest more of those public funding into sometimes restoration, mitigation of the aftermath of the border wall. What we know is that border walls will lead to an evaporation process. So the flows may disappear for a while. You may think, as the governments will be stating, that it works. And if you look at a longer time span, or if you look at a wider space, then you will see that those flows have adjusted and are going elsewhere.
Are there solutions to the crisis centered around border security, or is it really something else entirely?
The real problem is sometimes thousands of kilometers away. People are most of the time willing to stay where they grew up. So people can't stay for many reasons. There is more violence, more insecurity, less jobs, more inequality. And at one point, there is the very last drop that will put people on the move for one reason or another. So we should be looking at what's making people move, what's making people want to migrate, and admit once and for all that most people want to stay where they grew up.
Elizabeth Vallée is the director of the Center for Geopolitical Studies at the University of Quebec. She joined us from Montreal. Thank you very much for your time and for your thoughts.
My pleasure.
For more than a year, leaders in Southeast Asia courted Elon Musk, competing to host Tesla's new regional headquarters. In the end, Musk chose Malaysia, and this week Tesla's base opened there with the potential for thousands of new jobs. But to entice Musk to Malaysia, officials there actually waived a key employment law. And that has stirred up a debate, as the world's Patrick Wynn reports.
In most countries, affirmative action benefits minorities, but not in Malaysia, where the majority ethnic group, the Malay people, get special benefits that minorities, ethnic Chinese and Indians, don't, like college scholarships or a guaranteed quota of government jobs. Also, foreign companies coming into Malaysia are supposed to give ethnic Malay business people a sizable piece of the operation. Unless you're Elon Musk. The Malaysian Prime Minister, Anwar Ibrahim, was recently asked by Fortune magazine what he said to Musk to entice him to come to Malaysia.
I'm in business, and whatever is necessary will be done.
What was necessary to bring in Tesla was bending the affirmative action rules, a core national policy. Musk doesn't have to share any profits with Malays. And that's caught the attention of Malaysian citizens who think the law is archaic.
These laws have caused immense harm.
Mariam Mokhtar is a columnist for the news outlet Free Malaysia Today.
And the real cost to the country is widespread racial discrimination.
Ethnic Malays are 60% of the country's population. They're known as Bumiputra, literally sons of the soil, people with ancient ties to the land. Malaysia's minorities are mostly ethnic Chinese and ethnic Indians, descended from families who came in the 1800s when Malaysia was a British colony. To this day, these two minorities, on the whole, tend to be wealthier and more urban than Malays. But Mokhtar says ethnic Chinese and Indians have lived there for centuries, so treating them differently is just wrong.
It's cultivated a culture of fear. The fear of racial riots happening again is deeply embedded in them.
In the 1960s, whole Indian and Chinese neighborhoods were burned down in race riots. Politicians created the affirmative action laws to subdue class rage.
The intention of Malaysia's founding fathers was to level the playing field.
Adib Zalkapli is with Bauer Group Asia, a risk consulting firm. He says, yes, in the 70s and 80s, the affirmative action laws did pull rural Malays out of poverty. But that was a long time ago. I asked Zalkapli, does bending the rules for Elon Musk signal more openness to reforming the entire policy?
It's impossible because it is seen as a symbolic policy.
Symbolic of never letting minorities, whether British or Chinese or Indian, dominate the Malay majority. As for Elon Musk, Zalkapli says he seems to be getting a pass because he's famous and he runs X, formerly known as Twitter.
He is, after all, popular on X, and Malaysians use X a lot, so he is well known.
Musk also recently brought his satellite company, Starlink, to Malaysia. He'd normally have to team up with a local, largely Malay-owned company, giving it more than half the equity. But again, the Prime Minister, Anwar Ibrahim, waived the affirmative action laws. That's good, says Mariam Mokhtar, the columnist, but it will have Malaysia's Chinese and Indian citizens wondering, can't you just reform these laws altogether?
Why can't he do it for others? Why can't he start these reforms? So he can do it, but he did it for Musk. Why?
Even among the majority Malays, Zalkapli says, there is a growing frustration that the biggest benefits tend to go to Malays who are already rich.
Well-connected elites who are close to the ruling class.
In January, Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim will host a Bumiputra summit, where ethnic Malay politicians and business moguls will chart out the future of this policy. But don't expect this to produce big reforms, Zalkapli says. Now that the prime minister is waiving the laws for Elon Musk, he'll face more pressure to keep the status quo, proving he'll never abandon the sons of the soil. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
Nothing quite like old hardwood floors, but how about stumbling across wooden floorboards from the 15th century? Theater managers at St. George's Guildhall in the British town of King's Lynn recently discovered the original 600-year-old oak planks beneath a floor that was installed in the 1950s. Those historical floorboards would have been part of the stage that a young budding actor named William Shakespeare might very well have strode across while delivering a soliloquy. The theater says it has documents from 1592 showing that Shakespeare's company performed there. His London-based troupe headed to the eastern port town when the plague broke out in London, closing down theaters there. The discovery of the stage floorboards at St. George's Guildhall could be of great historical value if experts are able to prove that they are in fact part of the only existing stage that the Bard walked on. Just ahead, we stay on the literature theme. Syrian writer Khaled Khalifa died this week, leaving a legacy of prose and poems about a country he refused to leave even during war. And we also learn about this year's winner of the Nobel Prize in Literature. Stay with us. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. This afternoon at 1 p.m. in Stockholm, the permanent secretary of the Swedish Academy stepped through a pair of panel doors.
The Nobel Prize in Literature for 2023 is awarded to the Norwegian author Jon Fosse.
So who is Jon Fosse? In the theater world, he's renowned as a playwright. His work has been compared to plays by Harold Pinter and Samuel Beckett for Its Spare Language, and to fellow Norwegian Henrik Ibsen for Plumbing the Depths of the Human Soul. Nobel Committee for Literature Chair Anders Olsen put it this way.
In his radical reduction of language and dramatic action, he exposes human anxiety and ambivalence at its core.
Fosse's first play was produced in Paris when he was 40 years old. This recent production by Washington, D.C. Sena Theatre captures his sharp, punchy dialogue.
Someone is going to come. As soon as we go in, someone is going to come and knock on the door. Knock and knock on the door. Someone is going to knock on the door. Knock and knock on the door. And not give up. Just knock. Someone is going to come and knock on the door. Someone is going to come.
No. Can't you just sit down here on the bench beside me? No one is going to come.
Fosse says he stopped writing for theater after completing more than 30 plays.
I wanted to go into another mood, a slower mood, to write long sentences with a kind of flow to them.
Fosse's most celebrated work, a novel in seven parts, is a 1,200-page monologue. In very long sentences going for many pages, an elderly artist speaks to himself as if he were another person. Anders Olsen describes it.
The work progresses seemingly endlessly and without sentence breaks, but is formally held together by recurring themes and ritual gestures of prayer in a time span of 7 days.
We give Fosse himself the last word.
The writing itself is that which inspires me. I don't get inspired by this or that outsider writing. When I'm writing, I concentrate completely, more or less, on what I'm working on. One page takes the next in a flow. If I get into that kind of flow, it writes itself more or less.
Jon Fosse, winner of this year's Nobel Prize for Literature. He'll receive the award at a ceremony in Stockholm in December. It is a bitter paradox. The Syrian capital, Damascus, enjoyed a rich literary scene for centuries, and then the brutal civil war that began in 2011 sent many of the city's poets and authors packing. Acclaimed writer Khaled Khalifa was determined to stay put. This is my country, here is my home, my family, my mother is buried here, he says. This is simply my homeland, I have no other place, I don't want any other place. That's Khalifa speaking to his close friend, BBC journalist Lina Sinjab, in a 2019 documentary she made about him. Khalifa never did leave Damascus, but last week he reached the end. He died suddenly of a heart attack at the age of 59. Lina Sinjab joins us from Beirut. First of all, we're so sorry for your loss, Lina. A real bright light that we've lost. How did you first meet Khaled Khalifa, and what immediately struck you about him?
I met him in the early 90s when he was just starting with his career. He had published one of his novels and he had started writing TV series and started to acclaim fame in Damascus. And, you know, what strikes you about Khaled is this warm, amicable feeling that he gives to everyone around him. He treats everyone the same. He sits with people. He reads with people. He walks in the streets and greets everyone like members of his family.
Well, Exiled at Home, the short film you made about him, actually captures some of that. It also captures the loneliness that he dealt with. Let's hear a moment from that. That's Khaled Khalifa singing in the film while you're driving through the dark, deserted streets of Damascus. As you said, he was a close friend, but why did you want to make this film about him? Why was that important to you?
Well, for me, he's a symbol of the happy times in Damascus. you know, since I left in 2013, and I feel bitter about leaving, but I was forced to leave because I was under threat constantly from the regime and was arrested because of my reporting. But I managed to come in and out sometimes with like bribing my way in. So I wanted to make this film about him, about our life in Damascus, about the city and how it changed and how we both feel exiled. Since 2020, I am back on the wanted list and I can't go back. I wasn't able to attend his funeral. I wasn't able to say goodbye to him. I wasn't able to be with the friends who remained to cry together. But what I managed to do is I organized a farewell for him here in Beirut. We read some of his writing. We listened to his voices, the voice messages he sent to his friends. Some read poetry about him. Some played music. And then we all drank his drink, arak, the Syrian drink. And we also ate one of his famous dishes that he was cooking as he died, which is the stuffed aubergine. So we celebrated his love and his life here in Beirut too.
Tell us a bit about his career as a writer, Lina. What themes was he best known for? And was there a piece of writing that like every Syrian knows?
The first one that he became so famous for in the early 90s was the story of Al-Jalali, the Al-Jalali family, telling a story of a traditional family from Aleppo, where he originally comes from. But then he got his fame for his novel In Praise of Hatred, and he won the Najib Mahfouz Award for No Knives in the Kitchens of the City. Or he also talks about what happened within the Muslim Brotherhood period inside Syria. Then during the war time in Syria, he wrote Death is a Hard Work, which was nominated to the National Book Award in the U.S., So he's beyond the territory of the Arab world. And this year he spent 6 months in Switzerland on a writing residency, and he got back in end of June to Damascus. And he said, he wrote on his Facebook, it's the best return ever, you know, as if he knew that his destiny is arriving.
Amazing. Take us back to Khalifa in Damascus. I mean, he was a big man physically and really stood out from the crowd. What was it like wandering through the city with him? Like, how was he greeted on the streets of Damascus?
He was someone full of life and love, and he was witty and laughing all the time, loud, shouting. Even when he cooked, he created a mess around him. When he walked in the street, he wanted to, you know, show off with everyone, but with love. And, you know, almost everyone knew him. Even the cleaners in the streets would know him, you know, would greet him, would salute him. He was like the Santa Claus with his like white beard, walking with a big smile and beautiful eyes shining all the time, sending love wherever he goes.
You spoke earlier about the memories that surfaced during your memorial in Beirut for your friend, drinking arak, eating the aubergine. Lina, what memory are you really holding close about Khaled Khalifa?
His big smile. He lived a life fully. He was someone who is against all rules. He doesn't abide by any rule. He was, you know, messy and loud and full of life. He is someone who lived and died the way he wanted. And I think he gathered a lot of love around him, and that's what will stay.
BBC journalist Lina Sinjab telling us about her friend, acclaimed Syrian author and poet Khaled Khalifa. He died at his home in Damascus, Syria last week. Lina, thank you very much. Again, our condolences to you.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to The World. Canada wants to de-escalate tensions after accusing India of killing a prominent Sikh separatist leader on its soil. Meantime, Sikhs back in India are not so eager for a separate homeland anymore.
In Punjab, there is hardly any support for the Khalistan movement because Punjabis are practical people. They know what happened to Punjab, how Punjab suffered.
That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. On land, Ukraine's much-discussed counteroffensive has been dragging on for 4 months with little to show for it. But on water, there seems to have been some progress. In recent weeks, Russia has reportedly withdrawn most of its Black Sea fleet from occupied Crimea. That's after a series of apparently successful Ukrainian attacks. Our next guest is going to give us his assessment. Michael Kaufman is a senior fellow in the Russia and Eurasia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's in Northern Virginia. Michael, is there concrete proof that Russia has been pulling out its fleet from the Black Sea in recent weeks?
Well, it's not been pulling up from the Black Sea, but it has been rebasing, it looks like, a large part of the fleet from Sevastopol back to the piers in Novorossiysk, although it's not clear ultimately how many ships is going to end up moving there.
So rebasing, what does that mean, and what does it suggest to you?
Well, Russia's relocating a part of the fleet, and it looks like a number of the ships have moved to Novorossiysk. Novorossiysk is around 200 miles maybe east of where these ships typically berth in Sevastopol. The real issue in question isn't so much where Russia bases these ships. They weren't very much out and about in the Black Sea anyway. And much of their, I would say, contribution to the Russian war effort, or at least what they tend to do, is fire cruise missiles from the Black Sea. And they can do that almost no matter where they are positioned. That said, it does show that the Russian Black Sea fleet has become rather vulnerable where it's been based. It's within reach of Ukrainian air-launched cruise missiles. And for the past several months, the Black Sea fleet has lost the initiative in the Black Sea.
I mean, is Russia effectively closing up shop in terms of its naval bases in Crimea, or is it more nuanced than that?
No, it doesn't. I wouldn't put it that way. And it's not clear what this is going to look like long term.
From a strategic military perspective, what does this mean for Crimea specifically?
The real issue in Crimea, I think the challenge for the Russian military, is that Sevastopol has a number of facilities that are really key to maintaining the Black Sea fleet. And the question isn't really where the fleet itself is based. It's much more the vulnerabilities they have in those facilities. If they're lost, they can be very difficult to replace. In general, as you can see, the Black Sea fleet isn't able and not in a position to enforce any kind of blockade. But they haven't been doing that, to be perfectly honest. Russia's been trying to establish effectively an insurance blockade by threatening to attack shipping without really having its own vessels deployed to do so. Russia has anti-ship missiles based in Crimea. It can deliver ships via aircraft, submarines, it could mine the channel, what have you. The issue for Russia is they don't want to engage in unrestricted warfare either. They're trying to kind of create a blockade on the cheap, and it's not working out for them.
I mean, for Ukraine, this seems to be the kind of win that Kyiv could make a big deal out of. But really, what does this victory mean for Ukraine?
Man, it's the success of Ukraine's campaign to try to get the Russian Navy to displace from Crimea. If Ukraine is able to get shipping to resume at relatively high volumes, then it would be a major success. But it's not clear that the Russian military is necessarily going to allow that to happen. So it might be rather premature to start declaring a victory.
The Black Sea, let's remember, has been crucial for the rest of the world, waiting on grain shipments to get through so countries far and wide can eat. What are the implications of the Russian retreat for future shipments of foodstuffs through the Black Sea?
I'm not sure that there really is much. I think a lot of folks are probably looking to see to what extent Russia's going to challenge this corridor. And the question really is the Russian Navy going to engage in some forms of unrestricted warfare or not? It's clear that they don't want to enforce an actual blockade, but they also don't want the escalation that could come with unrestricted warfare, right? There are consequences of attacking commercial shipping, especially vessels that belong to other ships. And it could very much upset Turkey. And Turkey ultimately is the country that governs the access to the Black Sea. So there could be significant consequences for Russia there. And so I think they're trying to play it kind of in between two things that they don't want to do. And it's essentially created a dilemma for Russia.
So what does this development mean? When I say development, I'm talking about retreat to temporary or otherwise by Russia, when we consider the possibility of Ukraine taking back Crimea.
If you believe that the Russian Navy rebasing from Sevastopol to Novorossiysk makes retaining Crimea much easier, the answer to that is it doesn't. And Ukraine is nowhere near to retake Crimea. Here's the reality. I think that the best way, at least from my point of view, to look at it, is that Ukraine has engaged in a separate campaign to make it much more difficult for the Russian military to maintain its position in Crimea. Russia's obviously not going to just abandon Crimea militarily. I find that to be a rather ridiculous proposition. What's happening, though, is that the Black Sea fleet has not only lost the initiative, but is increasingly being squeezed by Ukrainian attacks because it's rather vulnerable where it's been positioned in the Black Sea. So these are a series of tactical successes, and they are notable. But it's not really clear what else can be said beyond that or whether it makes sense tying this to much larger strategic issues.
Michael Kaufman is a senior fellow in the Russia and Eurasia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He joined us from Alexandria, Virginia. Michael, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on the program.
The United States is the biggest producer of corn on Earth. Last year, the U.S. exported $18.5 billion worth of corn. More than a quarter of it went to Mexico. But when it comes to corn, this is a trade relationship that's been strained in recent years. Mexico's president is trying to ban the import of genetically modified corn. As Harvest Public Media's Dana Cronin explains, the president's decree puts cultural conviction against a major international trade agreement.
There's a saying in Mexico.
Sin maíz no hay país, there's no country without corn.
Without corn, there is no country, Diego Marroquin Bitar says. He grew up in Mexico and is now a fellow for the U.S.-Mexico Foundation, a nonprofit that supports trade between the two countries. He says corn, or maíz, is a linchpin in Mexico, going back millennia when it was cultivated by ancient indigenous tribes in the country's highlands.
Corn is quintessentially Mexican. It plays a really important role in the construction of the Mexican identity, and I think that's where the president comes from.
Back in 2020, Mexico's President Andrés Manuel López Obrador issued a decree to prohibit genetically modified corn in Mexico by 2024, citing health concerns. Here he is talking about it in a speech earlier this year.
Tenemos primero que cuidar la salud y también proteger las variedades nativas de maíz.
He says we have to take care of our health and protect our native corn varieties. And many Mexicans and Mexican Americans agree.
Heirloom corn is so special. It is over millennia and through generations of families has been bred to grow in specific regions and is pest resistant, drought resistant.
Emmanuel Galvin owns Bolita Masa, a micro molino and tortilleria in Berkeley, California. He buys high-quality heirloom corn varieties from different regions in Mexico and hand-presses them into tortillas and other masa-based foods. He says the inspiration for Bolita Masa came from his Mexican heritage. Galvin grew up here in the U.S. after his parents emigrated from Jalisco, Mexico. He says working with Mexican maíz has helped him celebrate that part of his identity. He gets emotional, recalling the shame he felt growing up.
I think part of why I work with maíz is to kind of reclaim this like thing that I shunned for so long and was like really looking down on because I was trained by society to kind of look down on this food that wasn't like, it was an other, right? It was this other thing that was foreign and kind of gross.
Galvin agrees with Mexican President López Obrador's logic in banning GMO corn for cultural reasons, but also for the country's health. He says in Mexico, maíz is a staple of the everyday diet.
It is most people's main source of protein and fiber. It's most people's main form of B vitamins and amino acids.
Over 90% of corn grown in the U.S. is genetically modified. It's been engineered to resist things like pests and drought and to tolerate herbicides. Mexico is the second highest importer of that corn behind China. Nancy Martinez is with the National Corn Growers Association and says a ban could really hurt U.S. farmers.
You know, if we can't export the majority of our GM corn, we'd have to find other available markets to put it. And that's not something that you can stand up overnight.
But the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement stipulates that Mexico needs to give scientific evidence in order to ban GMO corn. In essence, they have to prove it's bad for people's health. And Martinez says it's been proven to be safe.
So to kind of halt that scientific innovation because of this non-science-based, you know, opinion, that's really going to put us back.
And U.S.-Mexico Foundation's Diego Marroquin Bitar, who acknowledges the cultural reasons behind the ban, says it looks unlikely that scientific evidence exists.
There's actually studies that have looked into this and have found basically nothing.
Earlier this year, the U.S. requested formal trade consultations with Mexico, but ultimately failed to resolve the dispute. In August, the U.S. established a third-party dispute panel, which will make a final decision on whether Mexico's ban violates the country's trade agreement. For The World, I'm Dana Cronin in Oakland, California.
What does it mean to find home in a new country and feel at ease with a new language? That is the inspiration behind a massive mural in Miami Beach, created by an art collective from Spain, known for their vibrant designs and unconventional canvases. Kate Payne of WLRN in Miami brings us a story.
A giant purple wall rises against the clear blue sky.
This spot right here is wet, so we'll leave this spot alone until it dries, and then we can cover it.
My name is Pablo Ferreiro. I'm part of Boa Mistura.
Boa Mistura is a collective of artists from Madrid. They travel the world transforming blank walls and alleyways into swirls of color. Now, they're painting a pair of 3 million gallon water tanks overlooking Miami Beach Senior High School.
Some fragments of the letters from the word hogar and from the word home. M's and O's and R's and G's. All together, and they create this sense of transparency that allows us to play with color. That's the background. And on top of the background, we will write this Valentina poem.
Valentina is Valentina Mena, a 16-year-old at Beach High. And this is the Valentina poem he's talking about.
Finding my home in every voice that I hear, walking down the streets, wondering people's life. I know that I'm not alone, and my fears are shared. And that we are all searching for the best alternative possible. That's what reconforts me at the end of the day.
It's a very nice portrait of the essence, this migrant essence of Miami. In the poem, she expresses with this delicate balance of melancholy, but optimism at the same time, this sense of being new to an strange place, a place where you don't naturally belong. But you're getting used to live in this new place, right?
Valentina is quiet and curious, a dancer and a painter. She and her parents came to Miami from Villa Maria, Argentina, about a year ago, a move Valentina did not want to make.
At first, I didn't understand. Why do I have to go through this? It feels like coming here stole everything that I once loved.
Adjusting to a new country and a new language.
Well, it wasn't easy. That feeling, feeling lonely, became stronger. It's something that all people that had to go through that share the same feeling, so.
Then, one day at school, a team from the poetry nonprofit O Miami came to her class.
We all have the same assignment to, like, describe what means Miami to us.
Valentina says the words just flowed out of her, in English. Finding my home in every voice that I hear. Of all the student poems written for this project, that's the line that jumped off the page and was chosen by Boa Mistura to be the inspiration for this mural, called My Home, Mi Hogar.
This is like a miracle and like a light in my path to know what I should I do in my future. And
Valentina and her classmates got to help paint it themselves, layering coat after coat of vibrant color. Fuchsia, eggplant, indigo.
We worked together and it was so satisfying to like paint all the wall. Each section has its own color and it's very nice.
Valentina's English teacher, Tali Carmona, got to help paint too. She's from Brazil.
When I read her poem, like I kind of got teary-eyed because, you know, I'm an immigrant. And, you know, I remember when I came here to this country 30 years ago and how I felt. And I really, like, when I read her poem, I felt like part of what she was saying was my story.
Valentina says she wrote about what she wanted to be true, that she wasn't alone, that she could find a home here.
The poem is a piece of hope. Hope for what I was not seeing, but I tried to. Hope to heal with time. Hope to find a community that understands me. Hope for home.
The finished mural now towers over the football field at Valentina's high school, with her words in English and Spanish.
So nice to see like home and hogar, both in the same place, both languages. I will always keep that in my heart for the rest of my life.
For The World, I'm Kate Payne in Miami Beach.
The story was reported along with Summer Brugal of the Miami Herald. Last month, we told you about the significant ice melt with Switzerland's famous glaciers. Glaciologist Matthias Huss told us he actually saved a bit of ice from one glacier that is about to disappear for good.
I took down a little piece of the ice and put it in my freezer because I think my freezer is safer than the climate out there.
That belief got support today from scientists in France who had similar news about ice loss at Mont Blanc, its highest mountain. The iconic massif is encrusted with thick layers of ice and snow, but so much ice has melted in the past 2 years that the French news service AFP reports Mont Blanc's official height has shrunk by more than 2 meters. That's 7 feet of ice melting from the peaks. The lead researcher measuring the ice says the loss is due to lower rainfall in the summer. He declined to say any more about the findings beyond that. In Switzerland, though, Matthias Huss is unequivocal in his conclusion about ice loss there.
Well, the cause is climate change. This can very clearly be stated, and we can attribute almost all of the acceleration to the increasing temperatures during summer.
Researchers have been measuring Mont Blanc every 2 years for the past 2 decades, collecting data about the impact of climate change on the Alps. Canada appears to be backing down from a diplomatic row with India over the murder of a Canadian Sikh man, Hardeep Singh Nijjar, in British Columbia in June. Ottawa blamed the Indian government for the killing. Delhi denies any involvement. In the wake of the accusations, both countries have expelled a number of each other's diplomats. But Prime Minister Justin Trudeau now says that Canada is not looking to provoke or escalate. The dispute dates back to a bloody chapter in India's history. Hardeep Singh Nijjar had been calling for a separate Sikh homeland, which some in the Sikh diaspora strongly support. Sushmita Pathak reports from Delhi on where India's Sikhs stand on the issue today.
A metal gate on the grounds of a famous Sikh temple in Delhi leads to a memorial. It's similar to the 9/11 memorial in New York, with scores of names etched on the walls. Bhupinder Singh, Charanjit Singh, Harcharan Singh, Inderjeet Singh, Raghuveer Singh, Rajinder Singh. The list is just endless. Thousands of Sikhs were killed in Delhi in 1984, in one of the bloodiest episodes of religious violence in India's history. A caretaker of the memorial recounts some of the horrors.
बहुत बुरा माहौल था मैडम. हमारे कहते थे कि एक के ऊपर एक रख के आग लगा दी है.
Bodies were piled up and set on fire. People lost everything, she says. The chain reaction that led to that massacre was sparked by calls for a separate Sikh homeland called Khalistan. Nearly 40 years later, the separatist movement is back in focus.
We start tonight with Canada.
The India-Canada spat has dominated news broadcasts in India.
Because the Khalistani issue is rearing its ugly head and Canada's Prime Minister is giving it more oxygen.
Promoting Khalistan is banned in India, but pro-Khalistan activists organize freely in Canada, which is home to the largest Sikh population outside India. Many Indian Sikhs believe the Canadian government gives a pass to Khalistan supporters. That's because it wants their votes, says Jasmain Singh Noni, a member of an organization that manages Sikh temples in Delhi.
Ab sirf baat hai voton ki.
But in India, he says, Khalistan has few takers.
India mein Khalistan ki zarurat hum logon ko nahi hai.
We in India don't need Khalistan. If people in Canada want it, let them make it there. We are fine here, he says. The idea of an independent Sikh nation took shape in 1947, when the Indian subcontinent was partitioned into Hindu-majority India, also called Hindustan, and Muslim-majority Pakistan. Ashutosh Kumar teaches political science at Punjab University.
During partition, what had happened was that, there was some kind of voices that Hindus got Hindustan, Muslims got Pakistan. So what did the Sikh get?
Even after partition, there were calls for greater autonomy for Sikhs within India. In 1971, a Sikh dentist who had emigrated to Britain proclaimed Khalistan was an independent nation. Meanwhile, in Punjab, discontent grew against the Indian government, especially under Indira Gandhi.
When Indira Gandhi became the Prime Minister, there was undue interference in the state affairs.
Calls for greater Sikh autonomy reached a crescendo in the early 80s, with a violent campaign led by a Sikh preacher. Tensions between Hindus and Sikhs were running high, and in 1984, Indian troops killed the preacher after raiding the Golden Temple in Amritsar, where he was staying.
Attack.
The damage to the temple, one of the holiest sites in Sikhism, hurt the community deeply, says Noni. The attack sparked outrage, and as revenge, Indira Gandhi's Sikh bodyguards assassinated her, which in turn triggered the Sikh massacre of 1984. It gave momentum to Khalistan and sparked a bloody insurgency. But by 1993, the movement had fizzled out, says Ashutosh Kumar.
Because there was no popular support. Militants became highly unpopular because they were doing things which were unethical. Innocent Hindus were being killed.
The militancy also left Punjab battered. Investment dried up, industries moved out, and Punjab never really recovered, says Kumar.
In Punjab, there is hardly any support for the Khalistan movement. You know, because Punjabis are practical people, they know what happened to Punjab, how Punjab suffered.
Jasmain Singh Noni from Delhi says the time to ask for a separate Sikh nation is long past.
Ek time tha jab mil jata. Sikhs
should have been given a separate state during partition. It was our right, he says. But modern-day Indian Sikhs don't want their children to be embroiled in this fight, he says. It is a sensitive topic. On the streets of Delhi, Sikhs don't even want to comment on the issue. A 2021 survey by Pew Research found that 95% of Sikhs in India are proud to be Indian. Small pro-Khalistan groups still exist in Punjab, though. They held a rally in Amritsar last month to protest India's alleged role in the killing in Canada. At another protest in June, a pro-Khalistan leader said the movement was alive in India.
Khalistan di gal Punjab de har Sikh de mann vich ukriya hoya.
Meanwhile, political observers say the Khalistan issue could turn into an opportunity for Prime Minister Narendra Modi ahead of elections next year. Modi campaigns on national security and his government's tough response to the Khalistan threat could bolster his image as a strong man. For The World, I'm Sushmita Pathak in Delhi.
Music from the Middle East and North Africa sounds like this. It can also sound like this. It's this diversity of sounds coming from Morocco all the way across the region to southwestern Asia that is showcased this week in New York at the Habibi Festival. Habibi, the Arabic word for love. It's a relatively new event, started 2 years ago and quickly sold out all four nights. Same thing the following year. This is French-Algerian singer Nisreen, who is making her U.S. debut this week at the festival. It began as a convening of artists to explore the diversity of music from across the Middle East. As co-curator Mira Dugal told the WNYC program All of It this week, it's not as if New York lacks places where you can check out the range of sounds from this part of the world.
But we didn't feel like there was a dedicated space, a concentrated festival, to really shine a light not only on the local diaspora artists from this region, but also to create that connection and that bridge to bring artists from abroad here to the U.S.
It's just one of the dividends of the global profile of the city. Cellist and vocalist Nesreen herself has already picked up on that in the few days she's had to soak in what it has to offer artists like herself.
New York is a place where there is a lot of different people. The possibilities of meeting and of like mixing, the chance of the city is the diversity of people.
The Habibi Festival doubles down on that by presenting diaspora musicians in New York from North Africa and the Middle East and cross-pollinating them with colleagues like Nisreen from around the globe. The festival is happening through this weekend at Joe's Pub. Nisreen performs tonight and Saturday. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Join us again tomorrow. From PRX.